Hello and welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Daniel Ingranon. We've got a big show lined up for you today. We will be speaking with Greg Benick, keynote speaker and entertainer, and singer of the bands Between Earth and Sky and Trial. But first, we have Paul York of the University of Toronto Animal Rights Club. Stay tuned. Welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Daniel Ingranon. Our first guest today will be Paul York. He is an executive member of the University of Toronto Animal Rights Club. UTARC is a group on the University of Toronto campus that focuses mainly on vegan outreach and anti-vivisection work. The group has done film screenings, tabling, lobbying for vegan options, and has featured guest speakers such as Peter Singer and Ray Greek. The club also wants to help create animal activists by connecting students to the Toronto animal rights scene, such as the Toronto Pig Save, Sea Shepherd Society, anti-aquarium protests, etc., as well as nonprofits that do animal work, such as Mercy for Animals, Animal Justice, and Interniche. I'm excited to see what's in store for the club, so welcome to the show, Paul York.
Thank you.
Yeah, no problem. So let's jump right into it. Your group has been focusing particularly on eliminating vivisection and animal testing at U of T. Could you start off by telling our listeners about what are some of the current issues that U of T is facing with their animal research?
Well, there are several types of uses of animals in science. One of them is for education. So we think about the frog in the biology class, dissecting it. They use animals in that way. It's completely unnecessary because there are so many good humane alternatives to the use of animals in education. This is not even controversial. The representative for University of Toronto on this has even admitted that they could switch to that, but they haven't done it. Another type of use of animals in science is for product testing. They don't do that, to my knowledge. The third type, which is the most, in many ways, some of the most cruel experiments, are for medical research or applied research, and they do a lot of that at U of T. They actually use and kill about 90,000 animals a year at U of T for this type of research, and we're against that for both scientific and ethical reasons, and think that U of T could, again, switch to alternatives that are less costly, more ethically sound, and more accurate as well, because some of the most promising alternatives are using ethically sourced human tissue, which would be more accurate because it's more predictive. Well, it's not. The biggest problem is with use of animals in research is that it's not predictive for humans.
Mm-hmm. One of the more recent big issues that it looks like you guys have been tackling are the use of primates in research at U of T. Would you be able to explain to our listeners what the controversy has been there?
Yes. Last year, one of our members, Erica Tenenhaus, who's a primatologist, a PhD student at U of T, she discovered that there were a couple of monkeys that were being used through the dentistry department, Dr. Barry Cecil's work. He does chronic pain work, and these monkeys had been used and were slated to be killed, like all the animals there, but it was unnecessary to kill them, and she realized that, and so she urged University of Toronto to not kill them. And University of Toronto's response was, they deflected that issue, but what they said was, we're not going to use primates anymore. Then a lot of the research community at U of T, University of Toronto, was upset about that. This had been in the Toronto Star. So what they did is they told the ethics committee and that was a problem, and so that they needed to do more research on primates. And so U of T relented and backtracked and allowed the primates to continue or open the door for more primate use at U of T. The Toronto Star covered all of this, never interviewed us, of course, and it was a very one-sided coverage, I must say. And then they finally came out with an editorial in favor of continued use of animals in research. And the whole episode really was mysterious to me, how they could be so biased and how they could be so one-sided, until recently I read Tom Regan's Empty Cages, in which he describes how there is a systematic campaign by the animal industries to discredit animal activists and to, at the same time, vindicate themselves as humane and responsible And this all rang true from my experience with U of T and how they had approached it, because, you know, Dr. Harappa, for example, was in the paper, I think the Globe and Mail, saying that he had received death threats from animal activists. Well, what does that have to do with anything? I mean, first of all, our group is nonviolent. So this seemed to be a fictional thing that he was throwing into the story to prejudice the public against animal rights and to demonize animal rights activists, and at the same time take away attention from what the real terrorism that was occurring, which is in these labs. And the media fell for it, hook, line, and sinker. So there has been no progress on this issue at University of Toronto from the administration. It's deferred. I mean, one of the things that's most outrageous is that every science student at U of T learns that the insulin was isolated and discovered at University of Toronto in the 20s by Banting and Best, and that this is why it's necessary to continue to use animals. They use dogs in that case. Well, this is a myth, because if you read Mike Bliss's History of Insulin, and he's a professor of medicine at U of T, he's a very unbiased commentator, it reveals very clearly that it was unnecessary to use dogs in that experiment. It was a scientific dead end. And Ray Greek, who has written numerous books on this, cites that and says that this is yet another example of where they used animals, but they didn't need to. And it really was a dead end, scientific dead end, because non-human animals are not predictive for humans. Yes, mice share 80% of our genes, but the gene sequencing, the way the genes unfold in the embryo, is different. And so the results will be different when you give them drugs. That's why thalidomide was a failure.
Absolutely. Now, you've actually witnessed a bit of this yourself when you participated in an open rescue. Would you be able to describe that experience a little bit?
Yeah, this was actually just a couple of days ago. We put out a flyer. We put out a lot of flyers at U of T in the medical, to the science students and in the medical department or faculty of medicine. Most of them are taken down right away. But this particular flyer was urging people who were working with animals to donate live animals to us after they'd finished working with them, if they felt that it was unnecessary to kill them, which it is in many cases. In many cases, they don't dissect the animal and do research on the tissue, so the animals are alive, and yet they're killed anyway, unnecessarily, completely. So we put out this flyer, knowing that we could get a few, and I got an email from a young man who was, I guess he was a very compassionate man, even though he worked in a vivisection lab, and he allowed me to come to his lab to pick up these 8 mice that were not necessary anymore for their use. They were too old for the study, apparently. I went in there, and he had not cleared it with his the head researcher, who, when he told the researcher what was going on, who was a lady in this case, she had this shocked look on her face, like, and so I said very quickly, I'm just here, you know, I'm part of a group that does animal adoptions, you know, dogs, cats, and occasionally mice and rats, and we'll find a good home for these mice. Mm-hmm. So, and absolutely, I didn't let her know that I was an animal rights activist. And so she seemed okay with that, and I was just standing there while the fellow put them in the boxes. And while I was standing there, I witnessed the researcher and her assistant working on a mouse and injecting the mouse with possibly, you know, some deadly drug. I don't know. I didn't know really much about the experiment. I just know a lot of the research that occurs in that building is on cancer, but other diseases as well. So it was fascinating and appalling at the same time to watch an actual a mouse actually undergo this. And the mouse had to be restrained, was trying to struggle to get free. And they tried to make the mouse more passive with by putting some cotton in a test tube and putting something in the cotton to pacify the mouse and drug the mouse. And finally, they managed to get the mouse subdued and injected. And there was nothing really I could say or do about that because I had to be silent in order to save those 8 mice. Anyway, I have the mice, and they're extremely cute, energetic little guys, and they're up for adoption now. And I hope to get more animals who need a home. And these mice are, it reminded me a lot of Schindler's List, honestly, because the odds of them being saved are 1 in, I think, 11,000, based on the number of animals killed at U of T. So it was one of our happier moments, I could say.
I bet, yeah, that would have been really rough to go through, but I'm sure for those 8 mice, it felt really good.
Yeah, well, they'll have a nice home, and they'll live out the rest of their life as they should, and they won't be victims anymore. But there's all sorts of things, terrible things going on at U of T. We got a good report from U of T itself that was acquired for us through Anna Pippins, who's a lawyer for animal rights, who now works for Mercy for Animals Canada. And while she was at U of T, she managed to acquire this document, and I don't know how she did it, but she did. And it was a very thorough report that listed all the species that they used in 2010 and what they did to those species, and they, what are called the categories of invasives from the Canadian Council on Animal Care lists them from A to E. And I noticed that there were over 200 experiments that were Class D. And a Class D experiment is definitely an invasive and cruel experiment that would involve, for example, injection with cancer or open surgery on a live animal. I mean, for example, they don't use, dogs are a minority of the species they use. They use mostly 85% mice and rats, but you can look on PubMed.com, and anybody can do this at any time, and you can see, type in University of Toronto dog or University of Toronto mouse or whatever, and you will see the types of experiments that they do. Of course, it's all in scientific jargon, but we've been reading these, and a lot of them, I mean, there are, if you type in beagles, they do heart experiments on beagles. There are some pretty atrocious experiments. So when the University of Toronto, the biggest problem that I have with them is when they say that these experiments are humane and that they have to go through an ethics oversight committee, I would have to go along with Tom Regan on this one when he says that, and the animal industries that say that they're humane are lying, because there's no way that you can have 200 category D experiments on thousands of animals in a given year and call that humane. Category D, by its very definition, is inhumane. It results in, it's an invasive procedure against the animal's will and followed by death in almost all cases. So that's not humane.
Absolutely. We're almost out of time, so just one last quick question. How can U of T students or anyone get involved with the University of Toronto Animal Rights Club, and what do you have in store for us?
Right. Okay. So, well, one of the things is we do a campaign for science students that you can opt out of using animals and you won't be penalized, and Animal Justice, which is a group of lawyers, will support you in that. So we're really trying to do a lot of outreach to those science students. And if you know a science student who thinks that they have to use animals, they don't have to, let them know. We do a lot of vegan outreach. We do a vigil weather permitting, every Wednesday out on Harvard in St. George at noon to 2. We might have to move into the Student Life Center when the weather gets bad. There's a lot of activities, and the more people that join, the more we can do. So just send us an email at cruelandunnecessary@gmail.com. I think we're on Facebook too. And it would really be great if more students got involved. That's one of the things that I'm hoping that would that this interview helps with. We really need more students. We have a few students, obviously, but we need more. And this really is, it could be considered like a home for people who already care about animals, or who are vegans, who are students at U of T, but who feel isolated and alone, which is easy to do because the food there is terrible. So we, generally speaking, so we, if you care about animals and you're at this university, there's a club you can belong to, and there are people in the club who care about the same things you do, and you can join it and be part of that and, you know, consider it your home. Another thing is we want to go to the vivisection lectures more. I attend these lectures a lot. They're quite eye-openers. It can be depressing, of course, to watch a lecture showing a vivisector using how he uses the mice in various ways, but it's also extremely educational. And a lot of what we find out with these lectures is that, again, the experiments are not predictive. Sometimes the lecturers admit that there's an extrapolation problem or a non-homology problem. So this is quite eye-opening. If you care about the environment, you should join the club too or participate in it, because the single best way that you can mitigate your ecological footprint, reduce your carbon footprint, is by becoming a vegan. You can mitigate your footprint by about 25 to 30% and of greenhouse gases, and about 50% of your water footprint by being a vegan. And it's a lot easier than people think. And there's so many great vegan foods out there. So that's another purpose of the club, is to promote veganism. And a lot of people are really interested in that. And a lot of people want to become vegan, but they don't know how, or they're feeling unsure. So we exist to facilitate that and to help them with that. And we have a lot of really positive feedback and experiences with people going vegan. So
awesome. Thank you so much for being on the show, Paul. I look forward to hearing more about UT ARC, and we'll be sure to keep working closely together in the future.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. Thank you.
No problem. That was Paul York from the University of Toronto Animal Rights Club. Paul contacted me after this interview and requested that I put in a little footnote concerning animal research at the University of Toronto, which I agree is very important, so I'm just going to read it out for you now. U of T keeps its animals in very small containers that are inhumane, and also that the mice are killed without anesthesia, with the researcher snapping the mouse's neck with his or her fingers. Also, the CCAC, as you may know, is industry-run, and thus their standards, and U of T's ethical standards, are questionable to say the least. It's like the fox tending the henhouse, to use an animal metaphor. David Steibel has done a great review of this, and you can check it out at davidstybel.info/25.html. And we'll have that link as well as pictures on our website once the episode goes to podcast. Now, stay tuned for after the break, we have Greg Benick. Welcome to Animal Voices. I'm your host, Daniel Angernon. Today with us, we have Greg Benick, the lead singer of the bands Trial and Between Earth and Sky. He's also a keynote speaker and entertainer, and he has also produced the films Flight from Death and The Philosopher Kings. He has founded or co-founded the humanitarian projects 100 for Haiti, the Legacy Project, and the World Leaders Project. As a side note, I highly recommend his TED Talk in Puget Sound. It is absolutely captivating and inspiring. So welcome to the show, Greg Benick.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I really appreciate it. And that's a tremendous introduction. I hear all of that stuff and it almost makes me a little stressed. Like, where am I finding time to do all this stuff? But I totally appreciate you listing all that. It's really kind of fun.
Oh, no problem. You have quite the extensive resume, we'll say.
Thank you.
So first question, how did you get into animal rights and social justice?
You know, for me, my focus has always been more on human rights, ultimately. But then again, it's almost difficult to differentiate because, you know, there's really, as the term goes, an intersectionality amongst all of these issues, where being vegan or being involved with animal welfare or being involved with human rights all ties in together. It all ties in, not even necessarily just in terms of oppression, as we often hear, but it all ties in just in terms of making the world a better place for the most number of creatures and people so that we can all live live in some degree of equanimity and harmony. But I got involved ultimately early on in the 90s, and even before that, through Native American rights, through Native rights, and helping Native Americans with land rights issues. And I say even before that because I was introduced to Native issues even when I was in high school. I took a class in called Native American Studies, and it was taught by a Native American guy who just introduced us to culture and kind of went above and beyond what is typically expected of a high school class, meaning we really went in depth about politics and really went in depth about culture. And he talked to us from the perspective of his family and his life about what he'd experienced. And I got out of high school with this kind of energized brain about Native American politics and history. And then in the early 90s, when I found out about the Western Shoshone Nation and their struggles for sovereignty in central Nevada in the United States, I got involved with that struggle and immediately found just the sort of spider webbing or the branches or the tendrils or tentacles, if you will, out from there and the way that it integrated into so many other issues and so many other causes.
I saw on the bio that you follow your words about caring with action, and there's this theme of the importance of getting involved in a lot of your work. So I'm just kind of interested, like, how does, you know, your vegan or straight edge lifestyle influence this philosophy of action and social change?
Well, I think, you know, in my own life, I see the results of being vegan, and I see the results of being straight edge, for example, all the time. You know, I feel healthier as a result. I feel more energized as a result. And even though that sounds so simplistic and in a way self-centered, it's really not about me, meaning I feel energized as a result of being vegan and immediately think to myself, wow, what if other people who were sloth-like and overweight and completely annihilated from the sort of standard American diet, or as it were, the standard Canadian diet, could feel some degree of just being energized or being re-engaged with their own life, their own body, their own experience? What would the effect be on their psyche? Because I know that when I feel good about myself and about my ability to think and move and just experience life, I want to expand that outward. I want to share that with other people. I want other people to feel that. Well, what happens if others felt that as well? I think that there'd be sort of a ripple effect that could extend not only to people who maybe had never encountered veganism, but also just more creatures, more animals, more humans all over the place. And I think that that's where it stems from in me, is that sense that the way I live my life in terms of food choices or in terms of, you know, not ingesting alcohol or drugs, it really leads to this incredible feeling that I've never, ever certainly gotten tired of, but I've always been energized about sharing with other people.
Absolutely. I know you've mentioned the ripple effect in a lot of your work before. I've noticed, you know, in your humanitarian projects, such as 100 for Haiti, you talk about the ripple effect with, you know, helping out these villages and bringing it to the world, because, you know, it's about bringing the world together to help after the span of this earthquake. Can you maybe elaborate a bit on, you know, what this ripple effect means for your projects and how that can affect the world?
Yeah, I think ultimately what happens is that there is a sense oftentimes, at least in Western society, and by Western society, I mean Europe and West, and you know what, I'm not even going to make a geographical restriction on it. There is an effect that happens in society where people feel isolated. And it doesn't actually matter where you are in the world. I think that there's the potential for people to feel isolated. And when people feel isolated, they get inherently selfish and they get scared and they react based on insecurity and they live based on methods and modes of selfishness that exclude other people in order to ensure that they are protected, that they are safe, that they maintain stability in their own lives because they're afraid, because they feel alone. And I think that when you get a message or an idea out in the world that has integrity and has value and has some truth behind it, and that's a kind of a dangerous word to use because one person's truth most certainly could be somebody else's lie. But I mean, you know, ultimately, when you get a message out into the world or a mission that has integrity and sincerity behind it, people connect with that. And then all of a sudden, they don't feel so alone. And if they agree with it and they get on board with it, then all of a sudden they feel as though they're a part of something greater than themselves. So the ripple effect that I'm talking about is, for example, with 100 for Haiti. whether a couple of years ago and last year, where it was post-earthquake relief, and now it is essentially restructuring and rebuilding efforts in Haiti on the part of 100 for Haiti that we're involved in. When I put those ideas out in the world, and all of a sudden, for example, last year we did a program called 100 Shows for Haiti, where there was 100 basically simultaneous benefits around the planet. People feel the effect of that synergy. They feel the effect of that connectedness. Psychologically, they feel less alone in the universe and in the world. And realistically, they're part of something. And then that sense of being part of something, especially part of something dynamic and global, is energizing. And it gets people engaged and gets people wanting to take action and just be more present and serve more people. At least that's the effect that I've found. So I really stand by that idea, that through that ripple effect or that synergy, that it creates more of itself, just as at the same time as it serves to help soothe people's fear and terror and sense of being brokenhearted. So it serves a dual purpose, but it's definitely a way of propelling a movement forward.
Yeah, definitely. How would you say that this idea of sharing and connecting with the world, how would you say that translates directly to action?
I think that the moment of jumping to take action because of something that you see, I think it originates in a space in people where people are generally the same anywhere you go on a psychological level. And I mean that cross-culturally. I think that cross-culturally there are similarities and commonalities in the human experience that lead to us understanding one another organically, meaning when we cut the ridiculousness of our day-to-day lives and speak with sincerity and heart, I think that people connect with that, regardless of where you're from, regardless of what language you speak, regardless of your cultural background. You know, you can understand where people are coming from. And that's a very general statement, but there's some truth in that, and there's some guts to it, because when you post something on the internet that speaks to an inherent truth in you, even if I disagree maybe with where it's coming from, I can still connect with the fact that it's sincere and real. And what motivates me to take action is when I recognize or identify that people are sharing something that's true, something from the heart, something that means a lot to them. Whether that's somebody posting something in Africa about a situation there, or somebody posting something in South America, or somebody posting something in Calgary, or somebody posting something in Nova Scotia or Vancouver, it doesn't make a difference. I can sense when something is sincere and sense when something is real. And that's what inspires me to think, wow, what can I do? And even before that, there's a sense or a feeling of, I get that. Even if I don't think that in my mind, I get that. I get that thing that I see. I understand it. I'm connecting with it. And as a result of that connection, that's where action comes from. This is why if I was just to post go vegan, I don't think that people would respond to it nearly as much as if I posted a story about something that I saw, something that I experienced, how it made me feel, the reaction in me, and what I think the effect might be on the world as a result of me seeing that. People then, if I haven't written too much or spoken too long about it, people can connect with it and will connect with it, regardless of whether or not they switch to veganism right away or not. Doesn't make a difference. I think that they'll connect with the sincerity or the heart behind the statement, which is exactly what I would do if you posted something that was sincere and real to you.
Yeah, that makes a lot of sense. And I mean, I think that connects too with sort of what comes out with your music. I mean, I've noticed that many of the songs that you and your bands have written, you know, they focus on challenging that status quo of, you know, a lot of tough stuff, colonialism, intoxication, violence, war. But I've noticed they also come with this sense of revolution. So, like, what in your opinion is the role of, you know, music and art in inspiring this sense of revolution in people?
Well, I think that, you know, you use the word status quo. I think the responsibility of music in terms of establishing or igniting or creating a sense of revolution is starting with shifting, altering, or transforming or inspiring change in the status quo of the self, meaning that as I sit in my status quo, which every day is serving as a jail cell, which every day is serving as essentially binds, tying me to a norm which is constantly redefining itself, you know, every day, and I'm just trying to use examples of things which are restrictive, every chance I get to to break out of that status quo and think more expansively, more globally, more selflessly rather than selfishly, that's where any revolution is going to start. Any revolutionary action, whether that's the revolutionary action of being able to tell somebody that you love them after an entire lifetime of not being able to share your emotions, or if it's revolutionary action of showing people, like in a video, like Meet Your Meat, and devoting your life to that and getting out in the world and letting people know about the health effects and general effects and specific effects of veganism, whatever it might be. It starts with the status quo of the self. And I know that Trial, most definitely, was a band which talked about the status quo and continues to talk about the status quo from a political and social standpoint. Between Earth and Sky, especially on our album, is diving in more to that status quo of the self. Like, what happens now that we are self-aware and know that we're going to die someday and we're terrified of it? What happens as a result of that? What do we do with it? I mean, do we just sit around and wallow and just wait to die? Do I just cement my feet to the floor and just wait to rot away? Or do I take action and get out in the world and take some risks and you know, climb a tree and meet somebody and connect with people and network and kiss somebody new, or just eat something incredible and share it with somebody else, or just challenge myself and challenge the world? That's really where the responsibility of music lies, is in that challenge of the status quo of the self first, and then seeing where that takes an individual.
Yeah, and like, honestly, those are probably challenges that we should all be taking on every day.
Absolutely, absolutely. Because like, you know, like I said, like every day it changes, meaning every day, you know, there's a part of your brain that tells yourself, I can't do this, I can't do that. This is how I do things. Oh, I woke up at 7 o'clock today because that's what I do every day, because I go to my job every day, because that's how I pay my rent every month. And every year I stay here in this apartment because that's where I live. Well, that's already sort of that sort of binding process in place, because you don't need to live in that place or go to that job or wake up at that time. Meaning all of those are essentially rules that can be broken. You can do whatever you want in the world, you know, based on the resources at your disposal. And one of the things I've been doing most definitely on my spoken word tours is reminding people and reminding myself at the same time of the resources at our disposal, meaning they're limitless. It's not just the amount of money in your bank account. It's your ability to speak. It's your ability to connect. You're going to think I'm a crazy person when I say this. It's the speed of your internet connection, meaning I don't have a fast internet connection here, so I don't upload files, videos, things like that, that, you know, might benefit people. But maybe what somebody has to offer, even if they're a terrible speaker, they don't know, you know, what to do with themselves, if they have access to fast internet creativity and the ability to edit video, they could be uploading brilliant videos to inspire people to YouTube. You know, we have incredible resources at our disposal that we squander and take for granted, down to the time that we waste, the network of friends that we have to access, and the skill set that they can provide us. And when we get in touch with those resources, then, you know, immediately we all have a responsibility to utilize them to make for a better world, and to break out of those status quos, however they've manifested in our lives.
That actually really reminds me, there's this one quote in your TED Talk from Puget Sound, just kind of talking about the link between art and activism. And you were talking before about, you know, the limitless potential, and one quote you said was, that really struck with me, was, the artist continues regardless. From that, would you say that persistence would be the key to successful activism? Or what makes the artist such a good actor for creating and inspiring social change?
Yeah, well, and it's important. I think this is a great question. I think it's important to differentiate from the artist in, from a traditional sense, somebody who's painting, sculpting, singing, and somebody who is an artist, meaning somebody who is engaged in process, okay? And when I said that in the TEDx talk, specifically I was talking about the role of people engaged in process in life. And ultimately, the creative process is about going back and forth and back and forth and having tons of uncertainty. There's never a time in the work of an artist, and let's talk about the sort of traditional artist for a second, the sculptor, painter, singer, where you're coming up with lyrics and your first draft is perfect. Or you start carving, you know, the statue David in Italy and the first draft is perfect. It doesn't work that way. The first 150 iterations of whatever you're imagining you might be able to create are absolute crap. They fall to pieces, they break, they sound stupid and they look stupid. And then if you stay in that process, regardless of those failed attempts, then you come up with something, hopefully, that resonates. It doesn't have to be brilliant, it just hopefully resonates. So that process of staying in process, even when you feel completely confused and completely annihilated, that's what we're getting at here with this question. Because, you know, somebody who wants to create a sense of revolution, and again, revolution is defined countless ways by countless people. You're not going to come to the end point, because realistically, there probably isn't one. But you're not even going to come to the point that you want to get to right away. It's a process of trying, failing, meeting somebody. It doesn't work out. Communicating an issue, and you mess up what you're trying to say, and you sound like a complete moron. And then you keep going, and you keep going, and eventually the stars start to align, for lack of a better word, and you see that change, or that situation, or that status start to transform in the way that you envisioned it. It's the same way with writing lyrics, and I see it all the time. I stare at blank pieces of paper for far too much of my life, and then in time, all of a sudden, one line, another line, connections between a couple lines. I will present it to my bandmates, and they'll think, huh, this makes absolutely no sense. And I go, great. I delete the file, tear up the paper, go back, stare at a blank page for another couple weeks, and then come up with more. And then when I'm finally sincere with myself enough to really tap into some truths in myself, that's when all of a sudden things start to happen. And I think that the role of the revolutionary is to do the same thing. When one doubts his or herself, to stay in it, to stay in the process. And if the mission is sound, then the result will be there. It just isn't going to happen necessarily overnight or in any predetermined or any amount of time that could be calculated by any scientific method. It's very abstract. You just have to stay in it, step by step, walk directly into the dark.
What would you say for those who perhaps haven't per se entered the process yet? I know you tell a story in the TEDx talk about how you had to cross a river after the tide had gone up and you were scared, but the most important thing was to take that first step. So how would you encourage people that might have passion to take that first step into transforming that into creativity and action?
Well, it's a great question, but I might even suggest, and this is my answer to you, is that the first moment of that experience of crossing that sort of deep water wasn't, I've got to dive in, I've got to go for it, or I have to get across this expanse of water and I've got to go step by step. The first moment was actually me realizing, wow, I'm an idiot. I stood here on this island as the tide came back in, and I was so busy staring at the sky and imagining whatever was coming next in my life and where I was going to eat dinner and who I wanted to text and all this stuff, that I let the tide come in and I was ready to be absorbed, swallowed, and swept out into the icy cold waters of British Columbia. So the first moment was, I'm an idiot, recognizing that and being sort of in touch with that sense of humility and having it be real, because I was standing there facing having to walk across this icy water that was going to be chest or who knows how deep. And then taking step by step into the water. And the reason I share that is because the question that I get asked all the time is, but what if I don't have a band? Or what if I'm not a good speaker? Or what if I don't exactly know what I want to do? Well, that's a great place to start. Like, form a band, practice speaking, and start trying a few things until you figure out what you want to do. That's a beautiful place to start. Sitting back and saying at first, I'm clueless, or in my case, I'm an idiot, was a great place to start because it made me then accept the challenge of, okay, I'm not going to sit on this island overnight. I'm going to have to walk step by step and get out through the water, however I do it, unless a boat happens to come by or something, the water goes away. But for people who are asking that question of themselves, that is the first step. The first step is that initiation, that inspiration of wanting to do something and not knowing how and not knowing why. And just, again, step by step, stepping foot into the dark. That's why the walking through the water is a cool metaphor, because you don't know what's coming next. You don't know if you're going to get swept away. You're uncomfortable and scared, but you just keep going forward regardless. Well, it doesn't have to be that everybody who wants this has to walk through water in Canada in order to get to the other side with their laptop or whatever held high above their head as they're walking through this water. And I must have looked like a complete imbecile while I was doing this. Like, it's this great majestic story that I can tell in front of an audience and people get excited about it now. But realistically, if you watched me do this, you'd think to yourself, any Canadian would look at me and think, A, that guy's got to be American, and B, he's an idiot. But the key is that you enter into the process and you stay in it. And it starts from a place of not knowing what to do. That's a perfectly valid place to start. That's my point, is that you don't have to envision the Mona Lisa when you put paint on canvas for the first time. You could just say, I want to paint, or I want to do something, and just start. And who knows, maybe you'll come up with a Mona Lisa. You don't have to be a brilliant artist historically in order to create works of brilliance.
That's really cool. That's really grounding. That's That's great. I was wondering if we could switch gears for a sec, actually. In Flight from Death, your film, you explore how death anxiety can influence violent and oppressive behaviors. It's kind of a complex idea, I think. Would you be able to explain this further? But then I was also thinking to follow up, how would you say this idea contributes to the systemic oppression and killing of non-human animals?
Absolutely genius. No, I love the question. Okay, so Flight from Death was a movie that was made a couple years ago at this point, and it was made in conjunction with a film partner in Los Angeles. And the film is about the work of a cultural anthropologist named Ernest Becker, who actually ended up at Simon Fraser in Vancouver before he died and spent a number of years there. But Ernest Becker won a Pulitzer Prize for a book called The Denial of Death. And in The Denial of Death, what he suggested is that humans fear death like any other animal. But essentially what Becker suggested is that it's our ability to reason and think that gets us in a position where we almost are able to solve the problem of death, meaning through our creativity. And what he meant was this, is that we start to create systems, social systems, systems of truth and belief that make us feel as though we're going to last forever. For example, I feel as though hardcore is amazing. I love it. It's great music. I like that. I like straight edge. I like veganism. These are truths in my life. And they're not just about me. They're about other people too. So even if Greg all of a sudden gets hit by a submarine in 5 minutes in the middle of this interview and I die a watery death, there's still hardcore veganism and straight edge that's going to exist beyond me. So I'm part of something bigger than myself. And what Becker suggested is that that creates a mode of psychological calm in us when we connect with those cultural truths that we've surrounded ourselves with. Well, what Flight from Death is about, and again, we are just interpreting Becker's work in the film. It's not, these aren't our original ideas. We're interpreting Becker's work. What Becker's work suggests is that if I have cultural truths that I adhere to that make me feel better about my eventual demise, what happens when I run into somebody who thinks that hardcore is basically loud, annoying, screaming music that should be eradicated, and that veganism is stupid, and that a double cheeseburger with real meat and cheese sounds way better, and that straight edge would be cool if he or she didn't want to drink back a couple Jack and Cokes every night. All of a sudden, we've got a problem, because the truths that keep me feeling psychologically calm about life and death have been challenged by somebody else. So that schism is what Flight from Death is about, and that's what we delved into. If people want to, you know, see a trailer or, you know, get into the ideas a bit, you can go to flightfromdeath.com or ernestbecker.org, ernestbecker.org. That's the Ernest Becker Foundation in Seattle. They study his work. And to answer the important part of your question in terms of this interview, human beings get locked into this mode of thinking that through domination, through strength, that we will achieve greatness, or that we instantly achieve mastery over life and death. The psychology there, in part, is the idea that if we cause death in someone else, it's not us. If we cause death in something else, it's not us. Especially in terms of animals, if we eat or ingest animals, we have essentially absorbed their energy, and you know that might be true or not true in terms of whatever calories they, you know, include. But psychologically, we have ingested them and we have beaten them. They lost the game of death. We won because we're still alive and we're still here. So where this comes into play is in that psychology, meaning that when we start to challenge that, when we start to challenge the idea, it's depressing. Because ultimately, no one survives. Like, death has a 100% success rate. It's going to take us all eventually. But when we kind of get in touch with that a little bit more and realize that the cultural truths that we adhere to are illusions, they're constructive illusions, but illusions nonetheless, then all of a sudden the idea that we have to eat other animals in order to feel more powerful, or we have to eat other animals at all for whatever reason, it suddenly starts to slip away. I mean, specifically speaking in terms of veganism and animal welfare, we don't have to wear animals. We don't have to show our dominance over creatures by walking around in fur coats. It actually, quite literally, is a sign of insecurity. Meaning, you know, people who are, you know, wearing fur coats, cowards, and, you know, I can't, you know, and whatnot. But quite literally, they are insecure, and there's an insecurity based on a psychological fear of death at play here. Granted, there's another, I mean, I'm sure 100 other issues at stake, or other motivations for why people wrap themselves up in furs. But that wrapping themselves up in furs is at least based in fear of death from a, I guess you'd say, Beckerian perspective, and challenging the idea that these are truths, challenging the idea that these so-called truths will save us is really where the intersection is.
That's really interesting. And I mean, as Flight of Death explores how people may move towards violence, I'm kind of reminded of your work with the Legacy Project, in which you kind of seek out how places with legacies of violence transform into, you know, relatively more peaceful stuff. So what have you learned about successful ways of breaking this cycle of violence? What might you suggest towards breaking the cycle of violence, both towards humans and non-humans?
Yeah, you know, the Legacy Project is interesting. It's just ongoing, and there's just an endless amount to learn. And there's a direct Canadian tie-in as well. The Legacy Project started years ago as an offshoot, essentially, of Flight from Death, meaning that I wanted to bring Flight from Death to concentration camp cities originally around Poland, and show the film and hear from local people what their responses were to the subject matter in the film. Because ultimately, the film was made from a Western or American perspective. And I wanted to hear from people who had been in death-filled places, whether survivors of the camps or people who live near them, what their experiences and responses were. Because maybe ultimately they would say to me, you're insane, these ideas are stupid, and your film is dumb. And that would be a really fascinating response. But instead, what ended up happening was I ran this idea by a friend of mine who was a high school teacher, and we ended up bringing a group of high school students over to Poland and showed Flight from Death, for example, in the town where Auschwitz is, a town called Oświęcim in Poland, and then talked to local people about their responses to the ideas. And a year later, we went to South Africa, and we showed the film around South Africa in places where there'd been extreme issues of racism. And the sort of idea behind it was that in Poland, death was something that was applied to the Polish people, meaning that the Nazis invaded. In South Africa, death and fear and terror came from within in terms of an institutionalized, socially accepted racism and terror. And we've thought a lot about going to South America in places where it was invisible, meaning death squads coming in the night and causing death and keeping fear going. But all throughout, there's been this constant sense of growth with this project, because people finding reconciliation about violence and torture and death is worldwide at this point. And the Canadians, and this is the tie into Canada, just instituted a Truth and Reconciliation Commission like the South Africans did to deal with apartheid. But the Canadian government did this to rationalize and hopefully come to some degree of terms with First Nations people who were in Canadian residential schools, Native residential schools across Canada over the last century, century and a half or so. And the testimony you hear from people is gut-wrenching, just gut-wrenching testimony about their experiences of being tortured and their experiences of being sexually assaulted and their experiences of having their brothers and sisters killed and whatnot. It's astounding. I went to the hearings in Victoria a few months ago and was just riveted and just wrecked by it, and filmed a lot of it for what will be the next iteration of the Legacy Project site. But I think that again, it comes back to the sense of domination and a sense of power and what happens when we deconstruct our own sense of needing to dominate and needing to be powerful. And in terms of what has been effective in these processes that we've witnessed in South Africa, in terms of the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, in Poland, in terms of some of the reconciliation efforts involved that are going on there, and in Canada, and also, you know, in other parts of the world as well, we've done research, is where people forget and let themselves forget about their need for revenge and their need for violence. And the only way out at times, it seems, is when people take a step back and they say, I had this done to me, and instead of responding that I will then do that same thing to you, they take a step back and they say, all right, I just want to hear from you that you're sorry, or I just want to hear you admit that you did it, or I just want to stand face to face with the person I'm accusing and look them in the eye. You know, these sorts of things have been really effective in a number of different places. And the calls for justice and damnation and condemnation, they definitely ring out from time to time, but there are a lot of people who have been soothed by saying, and you're going to think that I've lost my mind again, but there are a lot of people who have been soothed, even in moments of saying, I lost my family, like this person killed my family, but I just want to stand across from them and say to them what that felt like and hear from them that they're sorry and then move on. Because some of these reconciliation efforts don't have a punitive side to them, meaning it's not like you come forward and say that, you know, you chop my parents into pieces, and then I get to say, okay, cool, now I get to chop your parents into pieces, or I get to have wild dogs tear you to bits. It doesn't work that way. It's like, you admit what you did, I hear you out, I tell you how it felt, and then, unless there's extenuating circumstances, we move on. I mean, that's like a new model for justice. That's not the American way, where it's like, you know, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth. I mean, that's a really transformative model for justice. It's almost like justice without justice. So I think that in terms of animal activism and in terms of activism overall, thinking creatively and thinking compassionately rather than thinking aggressively and thinking violently are going to yield incredible results, which isn't to say that's the only way to go in life. But I think that's a really positive and encouraging method in terms of bringing about action and change. Because you can get inspired aggressively from your compassion as well. But I think that initiatives which originate with a sense of compassion and a sense of humility in a way are really sort of a way of the future. And I'd really love to hear about what people's responses are to that.
Absolutely. Just a quick plug, I guess, if any of our listeners do want to respond to that question, you know, feel free to email us at animalvoices@gmail.com and we'll pass on the message to Greg. We're almost out of time, so I just have one final question. I actually just wanted to touch on your other film, Philosopher Kings, for a moment. Now, in this film, the filmmakers go to prestigious American universities and interview the custodial staff, which I think is a really cool concept that serves to send a really important message about appreciating underrepresented voices. And I mean, our show is called Animal Voices precisely because of that. So I was just curious what you would like to see happen so that more of these voices and stories are heard and considered.
I would love to see people just learn to listen more. You know, there's a great irony, right? Because I make my living as a speaker. I go out on the road and I speak to all different types of organizations, groups, what have you. Or when I'm doing spoken word tours, I'm going out in just, you know, a myriad of venues all over the planet speaking to people. But there's a great irony in the fact that I'm a speaker about to say what I'm about to say, which is that people need to learn to listen more. And they need to learn to listen in a lot of different ways. They need to learn to listen to people who they perceive as powerful. They need to learn to listen in different ways to those people. They need to learn to listen to people who they see as powerless and worthless, learn to listen to those people. And they need to learn to listen to themselves. And I think the message of the Philosopher Kings, or for that matter, I think we might have mentioned it in the opening, in your intro bio, but the World Leaders Project, where I went to visit with, and I wrote to world leaders and tried to meet with them and met with the president of Guyana just to hear what his ideas were about racism and violence in Guyana. The idea that why can't somebody who is powerful or perceived to be powerful just come down to the level of somebody who is asking a basic question? Can we listen to our leaders in new ways? Can we listen to the leaders that we elect in new ways? Because there's a somewhat of an inevitability, meaning I doubt that there's going to be a situation, at least in America, in 2 weeks where nobody's elected president. Oh, we've just decided to let it be a free-for-all. We'll figure it out, folks. No, there's going to be somebody that we elect. Can we learn to listen in new ways? Can that person learn to listen to us in new ways? And that sounds a little abstract and a little too hopeful. But for individuals, meaning ourselves as vegans, ourselves as compassionate activists, how can we learn to listen to people and those around us better? How can we interpret their words in new ways and take action based on what we hear when we sort of cast aside our preconceived notions of what those people are based on social status or based on the status of their perceived power? Because I think then that we empower ourselves because we start to, as I said, and this is another component of this, listen to ourselves, listen to our hearts. And when we do, then we're able to move forward with a degree of sincerity that is going to fuel us like fire in everything that we get involved in. Because it goes back to what I was mentioning before. When we're locked into patterns, one of those patterns oftentimes is assuming that we have no voice and assuming our voice is powerless. When we learn to listen to the sort of rumblings in our hearts that are the origins of our voice, and when we respond to that call, then it's limitless what we can accomplish.
Amazing. And I think that's a great note to end on. Do you have anything else you want to quickly add for our listeners? Any final thoughts for us?
Yeah, I'd like to offer a sincere thank you to your listeners because one of the greatest resources we have in life is time, meaning we each have limited time, and your listeners have just managed to spend some 40 minutes listening to you and to me ramble back and forth about ideas, and that's 40 minutes that they never get back. So hopefully that 40 minutes was deemed as valuable. And if they have any questions, any comments, if they'd like to be in touch, like you mentioned before, email, and I'd love to receive your forwarded emails anytime and answer them. I'd be happy to.
If you want to find out more about Greg and his projects, you can head to 100forHaiti.org or wordsasweapons.com. And that's all the time we have today for Animal Voices. Big thank you to our team, Aaron O'Sullivan and Neil Harvey, for being our audio technicians, Taylor Book on social media, and Kevin Tillman, our music collaborator. If you have any questions, comments, concerns, responses, anything, feel free to email at us at animalvoices@gmail.com. Animal Voices is produced locally in St. Catharines at CFBU 103.7 FM and broadcast in Toronto at CIUT 89.5 FM. I hope you all have a great week.